legend becomes fact. Print the legend.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Trusting in the sanity and restraint of the United States is not a strategy, and it is not an option.
We don't need no thought control.
What's a conspiracy notion out there? How much influence do you have? Was it you and your fellow neoconservatives that created the momentum towards overthrowing Saddam Hussein?
Nobody does a thing in this town without our approval.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, a secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets.
Welcome back to Cloak and Dagger. I'm your host, Lenny Bloom, along with my co-host, the great American judge, Buster Sherman Skolnick. Sherman's away right now with family situations. He'll be back next week. Joining me on our regular Webster Tarpley briefing evening is, of course, Webster Tarpley, here to scrape the bullshit off the truth. Welcome back once again, Webster. It's great
Thank
to
you,
have
you. Thank you, Lenny. It's great to be here. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Much has been going on. You were away last week on assignment in New York. Why don't you theme us in for all the cloakers that are interested to hear your briefing?
Well, I just have to say my travels were to New York City. On Sunday evening, I was at St. Mark's Church. It's actually St. Mark's in the Bowery originally. The building I was in was about 200 years old, I guess, and it's part of the area called the Bowery. The Bowery was the farm of Peter Stuyvesant, right? Bow meaning something like agriculture, right? Like in German, Anbau.
Yeah, is that like? And they had a movie in the 30s or something called The Bowery Boys. Is that where it's
from?
Yeah,
the Bowery then came to mean a street with a whole bunch of drunks and pathetic winos. That's what the Bowery as a street. This is when it was a district.
I see.
As a street, it becomes associated with people who have sort of given up on life, and then the Bowery Boys were the kids who in the 1930s came from that neighborhood. So that's a complicated story. The church that I was in is the one that has the tomb of Peter Stuyvesant, the old governor of the Dutch colony of New York in the 17th century. Now this is a very good church. Congratulations to the Reverend, because it is the scene of any number of very interesting political activities. And the one I attended was the Sunday night lecture series of New York 911truth.org, I believe. So ny911truth.org. They have somebody there every Sunday night of all types. They have MyHop. They had MyHop with me. They have LIHOP. They also have unanswered questions. They have unanswered questions coming this Sunday, so there's plenty of grounds for debate and disagreement. There were about 250 people there. It was announced on WBAI, and I want everybody to know that there was a strong Cloak and Dagger faction there. There were two very nice people from Rego Park in Queens who said that they listened to this broadcast every Thursday night, and then they start calling into various large radio broadcasts, coast to coast AM or whatever it turns out to be, and therefore there is a tremendous multiplier effect on these ideas, and I think that's on the whole extremely encouraging. So more power to Cloak and Dagger, for sure. That was one of the things that came out of this.
That's terrific, Webster. I'm glad we're making some inroads there. Certainly thanks to your great hard work and input. It's just wonderful having you as a regular guest and a regular giving us an update and keeping us on the straight and narrow.
This was, among other things, the world premiere of the second edition of my book, the second edition of 9/11
Synthetic Terror.
Tell
us again,
Terror.
And where everybody can where do they get it again?
I would go to Amazon.
Amazon yeah.
has it heavily discounted, and if you get it through Amazon, you can put the 9/11 Synthetic Terror together with the Bush biography that you just mentioned, and you get all of that sent to your house. Much less than the cover price of the two books, and you also get free shipping because they have this super saver shipping as soon as you get over $25, and this just goes over $25 by a little bit. So I think you can get both books sent to your house for something like say $25 to $30. Don't quote me directly, but or that or a little bit more. But it's a very reasonable economic way to get your hands on these books. And as my publisher always tells me, every time we sell on Amazon, we get closer to getting into some bookshops, which we're still trying to do. So that was the New York 9/11 Truth Lecture Series, St. Mark's in the Bowery. You can also find it on a website called summeroftruth.org, I believe. Anyway, look up Summer of Truth. That's Nick Levis, who is one of the organizers of this. And more power to the organizers who keep the 9/11 issue alive. These are also people who go to they go to Ground Zero every week, I believe on Saturday, for demonstrations. And there's also a free speech case that I'm going to try to tell you about next week, because if I have the documentation, it's Union Square in New York City.
Yep,
is always a place where free speech. It was a little bit like Hyde Park Corner. Under Mayor Bloomberg, it turns out that you're not allowed to have a 10-watt amplifier so that you can be heard above the traffic noises. So there's a group of free speech advocates who have been going down to Union Square repeatedly and exercising their First Amendment right to free speech, and Bloomberg's police are coming to say you're not allowed to have this 10-watt amplifier. So why don't you go get a permit? Well, they won't give you a permit if you go and try to get it, because they don't like what you're doing. So the idea is then you're supposed to be shut down or just reduced to lung power, which for most people is not enough. So Mayor Bloomberg is guilty of trying to muzzle dissent and free speech, even in Union Square, which is the one place, again, the Hyde Park corner of North America, where you'd think that free speech would be honored.
Yeah. Well, free speech is not being honored in the United States, and you've been talking a lot about that for the last year or so. But why don't you theme us in? You're one of the
first
ones.
Why don't we practice a little free speech right here now, okay?
Yeah, you're
wonderful.
One of the first ones to mention quite a while ago about the plans of these of the Bush junta to go into Iran, and more it seems like Webster, you had your ear to the rails and were way ahead of the pack. Why don't you theme us in on what's going on next?
Well, we can't be 100% sure of everything, but it does look very, very ominous and very grim. And I think if you look back now on this age that we're living in from some decade in the future, if we're that lucky, it'll probably be the case that this is the week when the Iran war issue broke into, let's say, the front burner status of world public opinion. And it goes something like this. There was on Monday, the 16th of January, we're now speaking here, it's Thursday, the 19th of January. This today, by the way, is Orthodox Epiphany for the people who celebrate that, and there are quite a few in the Orthodox world, so happy Epiphany to the Orthodox. Today's the 18th. Back on Monday of this week, we had this conference in London.
Webster,
yeah.
It's the 19th today.
I'm sorry, the 19th. Today's Orthodox Epiphany.
It's today on the 19th?
Yeah, okay. I think it is anyway. That's what I've been told by those who know. This was the meeting back on Monday in London was what they call 5+1. It's the permanent five, the five permanent nuclear power members of the UN Security Council: Britain, France, United States, Russia, China, plus Germany. Germany is there by virtue of representing the EU3, which is an oligarchy within the European Union. In other words, instead of having the 25 countries or 26 of the European Union, we've got this group of three, which is already bad, and bad especially because the British obviously are the dominant ones within this. So the question was, what should happen to Iran? Now, Iran on the 10th of January had broken the seals on certain of its nuclear laboratories and nuclear facilities,
mm-hmm.
and had said that they were going to go back to the enrichment of uranium. Now, remember, under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, they have every right to do this. They are absolutely within their rights.
Mm-hmm.
So anything to the contrary is a hypocrisy. Whatever their long-term intentions vis-a-vis nuclear weapons may be, they haven't violated anything at this point. Now, Condoleezza Rice had worked very, very hard to try to orchestrate a lockstep to try to force China and Russia in particular, but also the European powers, into a lockstep on Iran. And it is clear that this did not happen. Condoleezza Rice came out and tried to give her spin, but we heard from the Russian foreign minister, Lavrov, right after that meeting, saying that sanctions, in his opinion, are not the best way to deal with this crisis. What Condoleezza Rice wants is for the International Atomic Energy Agency of El Baradei in Vienna to come to a finding that Iran is in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that this case also ought to be referred to the United Nations Security Council for action, which could be sanctions or could be military invasion. In other words, Chapter 7 measures under the UN Charter, which would be the use of military force to reestablish international peace and security. So Lavrov came out saying sanctions are not the best way. Putin, on the same day, on Monday, came out saying we do not need any abrupt, erroneous steps.
Oh, really?
Considered a direct polemic against Condoleezza.
Yeah.
And Russian Defense Minister Ivanov said Russia is firm in its intention to sell the Tor-M1 anti-aircraft missile system to Iran because this is purely a defensive missile system. Well, they better get a move on and speed up the delivery of that. So one great power, one of the Perm Five, Russia, seems to be unwilling to vote for sanctions, let alone to vote for military actions. Also, not even clear that Russia would vote for the International Atomic Energy Agency to refer the whole thing to the UN Security Council. Now, the Chinese, always understated, right, always inscrutable, if you like, but their foreign ministry said that what is needed is a peaceful solution attained by means of diplomatic negotiations, and the Chinese UN ambassador also supplemented that by saying to refer the whole matter to the UN Security Council might complicate the issue, so not a good idea. So if we look at that, that's already a bad result for Condoleezza. Now let's go a little bit further,
okay,
in terms of the diplomacy around the issue. Today, Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, and this is an unpredictable fellow, as we know, but now he's acting in his capacity as president. Ahmadinejad is on a visit to Syria in Damascus today, the 19th, for 2 days. Ahmadinejad met Bashar Assad. Now, these are the two old allies that are left over from the 1980s, from the Iran-Iraq War, when Syria, as is known, sided with Iran. I think that's important. We've also had a very cordial exchange between Iran and Tajikistan. This is another country in the area that the U.S., of course, is trying to pressure to become hostile to Iran. Remember that the Tajiks are Persian speakers and do go culturally with the Iranians. So the access between Dushanbe, Tajikistan, and Tehran, Iran, is strong. And we've had this exchange between Rahmonov, the Tajik president, and Ahmadinejad. So Iran continues to call for negotiations also in that context. Now, Cheney is on a visit to the Middle East. This is partly what was interrupted before Christmas when he had to come back and pass certain reactionary legislation using his tie-breaking vote in the Senate.
Right.
Above all, Cheney was in Egypt, and Cheney was trying to arm-twist Mubarak into supporting various kinds of measures. I'm sure it goes all the way from sanctions to war against Iran. And there's also a sense in which the U.S. wants to get Egypt into Iraq as a means of embroiling Egypt with Iran. In other words, to get Egypt into Iraq would mean getting Egyptians killed by Shiites, right, in Iraq.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the Iranians would come into the picture. Anyway, that doesn't seem to be working too well for Cheney, because the spokesman for Mubarak came out and said, we don't really understand, we don't like the fact that there's all this fuss about Iran, so much attention for Iran, and a complete blind eye for Israel and all of their nuclear weapons, and we cannot ignore Arab public opinion on that. So that doesn't sound too good for Cheney there either. Pakistan, this is another country that they're going to be leaning on. Well, before we go to Pakistan, though, remember also that Cheney is going to be going to Saudi Arabia. He's going to try to get them involved in the attack on Iran. Saudi Arabia is notoriously very reluctant to do that because they fear Iran, their neighbor across the Persian Gulf. And the Saudis know very well that the only thing that saved them from Iran in the 1980s and early 1990s was Iraq. And now Iraq has been smashed up, so there's no more Gulf Cooperation Council with Iraq that would provide some kind of a counterweight to Iran. So Saudi Arabia's in big trouble. I don't know what they're going to say. There's also the fact that Cheney is going to visit Kuwait. The occasion for that is, remember Jabar el-Sabah?
Yes.
The butcher who brought on the first Gulf War, this guy who was sitting there with his slaves and his harem, and then was driven out by the Iraqis, and then reimposed by the U.S., one of the most shameful stories. Anyway, this benighted, medieval, backwards, slave-holding, harem-running monarch has gone to his internal reward. So Cheney is now there, I think, if not for the state funeral, then to pay his respects for the emir, the now dead, deceased emir of Kuwait. In Turkey, Turkey, another key regional power, right? Turkey says, this Prime Minister Erdogan, he says, Iran has the clear right for peaceful nuclear energy. Now, that would seem to indicate that what we had in past weeks, right, that Turkey had promised Russia that they would not be a party to any attack on Iran. In Pakistan, as I was beginning to say, we had some weeks ago the Pakistani foreign minister not favorable to any attack on Iran. Even the rhetoric may be there, but the rhetoric was we would join with them. We would be on the side of Iran. Again, two powers in a very similar situation. They're Muslims, but not Arabs. They both have nuclear weapons. It's clear whatever happens to Iran today will happen to Pakistan tomorrow. So Pakistan is not favorable to the attack on Iran. Pakistan today said they warned the United States, don't make any more airstrikes on our territory, which is about the mildest thing that you could expect, but at least they did say this. India, of course, behaves more like a U.S. puppet than anything else under the current rulers. This is much to be deplored. They wanted to pick a quarrel with Iran. Iran had simply pointed to the fact that the hypocrisy and double standard of the U.S. Remember, that India and the U.S. last year signed far-reaching nuclear weapons agreements. India is now de facto nuclear power, right? They've had tests in the late 1990s. Nobody has proposed doing anything about Indian nuclear weapons, which are now there. This is a neighbor of Iran. Remember, Iran is facing Israel with 500 nukes. It's got Pakistan in the neighborhood with nukes. Relations are probably fine, but you never know. And then India, where relations are not so fine. Anyway, India says they very much regret the fact that Iran has pointed to the preferential treatment of India as a as an example of this double standard.
Yeah, exactly.
Multiple standard. India says you shouldn't do that because India is a responsible nuclear state. Well, that's again the language of the double standard that we can find in this. Now, the French, unfortunately, they've been so weakened by those Anglo-American destabilization riots last November that they are taking on the role. It's really a shame, right? It's really quelle honte, right? What a shame! What degradation! The French, who organized the world against the Iraq war, now seem to be trying to organize the world in favor of the Iran war. The French Foreign Minister, Doust Blazy, is on his way to Moscow, or there by now, to try to turn Moscow against Iran if they can. Very unlikely because of the tremendous cultural, above all, commercial dealings between Moscow and Iran, not just those missiles, but also the nuclear reactors themselves,
uh-huh,
and all the Russian technicians that are there who would die in an attack, or many of them would. Similarly for China, China's buying $10 billion of oil from Iran every year. So the Indians are playing a perfidious role, and I'm afraid the French are not doing too well either. We have some German commentators are pointing to the fact that to go down the path of sanctions, even with Iran, is, it's a very dangerous path.
Yeah, that's true.
In terms of the U.S. CIA provocateurs, we had this unbelievable case of CNN, right, cable news network from Iran, and this was Christiane Amanpour. Remember Christiane Amanpour?
Yeah.
Amanpour. She, of course, is married to Jamie Rubin, the former Assistant Secretary of State of the United States. He was the spokesman for the State Department during the bombing of Serbia. So what they did was, this was a speech by Ahmadinejad, and of course he speaks in Persian, so they gave a translation. And whenever Ahmadinejad said nuclear technology, he'd say, "We have the right to have nuclear technology," they would translate that for the English-speaking audience as, "We have the right to nuclear weapons." So nuclear technology becomes nuclear weapons, and the Iranian government, I think, with a great deal of justification, banned CNN from broadcasting from Iran. But now you can see, the word has gone out to these CIA worms and cockroaches in the media that it's time to start blowing the horns, right? Christiane Amanpour, in this case, you know, she belongs in the same stable with Judith Miller, of the New York Times, and the rest of these neocon stenographers for the various warmongers. The newspaper Jumhuri-e-Islami says that Christiane Amanpour is a CIA and Mossad agent with a very bad record. Now, let's see. So they, I think that's some idea of this.
They're saying sometime in March, like March 25th or something.
Yeah, March 20th. Remember, March 20th is the date that was given by Sharon to his generals, saying, "I want you, you know, Mofaz and company. I want you, Danny, the new Supreme Commander of the Israeli military. Be ready by March." And of course, we know, and I guess we better stress this again, the real story here is that March 20th is the opening of the Iranian oil bourse, the Iranian oil exchange or oil market, which for the first time is not just Iran willing to sell oil for euros, but it is a market where anybody can come and buy oil from anybody who wants to sell it for euros. And this is an absolutely indispensable precondition for the entire oil market in the world being freed from the monopoly dominance and reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar, which has now become absurd, obsolete, and indeed a prop to this militaristic clique that we have here in the Pentagon. So, again, other countries have sold oil for euros. That's
right.
Not the big thing. It's, is there a market where you have futures, where you have various kinds of market transactions,
right,
where you can hedge, where you can do all these things? Remember also that a lot of oil is sold through long-term state-to-state agreements or company-to-government agreements, right? Typically, it would be a third-world oil-producing country acting through its state oil company that would just say, we will sell on a long-term basis a certain amount each month or each week to some oil company, say, in the West or in Japan or China or whatever it is. But if you want to go beyond that, if you need a spot market where you can go and buy oil immediately, right, say to cover an immediate shortage or an immediate need, that takes a market. And nobody but nobody has ever had a market. The markets that exist in the world are the New York Mercantile Exchange, the International Petroleum Exchange in London, and there's another one in Dubai. And there is a branch of the International Petroleum Exchange, I know, in Tokyo, but again, the New York Mercantile Exchange. So the New York NYMEX in Tokyo, you can buy and sell oil there, but only in dollars. The prices from Tokyo come in quoted in dollars. So the Iranians are talking and going beyond that, and that is, of course, an epoch-making watershed. It's the beginning of the end of the dollar, and it would be also, as we've discussed in other programs, a prelude to a lot of central bank reserves and hot money and other money leaving the dollar in favor of the euro, or leaving the dollar in favor of other destinations, be it yen or gold or something else, which would tend to deflate the U.S. housing bubble, the U.S. stock market bubble, and just the general bloated, impossible situation of the U.S. dollar with a $750 billion foreign trade deficit that nobody else in the world is allowed to have. So that, I think, is the underlying reason. And every time they talk about nuclear weapons, as we've been talking about here, remember, this is largely a pretext. I mean, we had a discussion in New York after this this meeting the other night. Again, Israel has 500 nuclear weapons. India has nuclear weapons. Russia has nuclear weapons. The U.S., the British, the French, all plenty of nuclear weapons. What possible difference could 5, 10, 20 Iranian nuclear weapons make? They don't make any military difference when you get right down to it in the larger strategic sense. The hysteria seems to come from the fact that the Iranians are going to do something that does, it really does have the ability to do permanent strategic damage to the U.S. imperialist operation, and that is this Iranian oil bourse. But before we leave the warfare side of things, we have a very interesting scenario in the Daily Telegraph of London, and this is from the 15th, a couple of days back. This is Niall Ferguson. You know Niall Ferguson?
No, I don't.
He's a neocon. He is a neocon historian, and he wrote a book called The Pity of War, which is a study of the beginning of World War One. And it is an attempt to attack certain myths, I guess, in connection with the beginning of World War One. But since then, Niall Ferguson has come out more and more as simply a raving neocon ideologue. And, of course, he works for the Daily Telegraph, which is the newspaper, which until a couple of months ago was being run by Lord Conrad Black, who is now under indictment, right, because this was the Hollinger Group. So this is his scenario. It goes something like this. The U.S. neocons were urging Bush all during 2006 that it was time to attack Iran. However, Condoleezza Rice thought that diplomacy would be allowed to do the job, perhaps with some economic sanctions.
Uh-huh.
Tony Blair wanted to convince Bush to attack, But by now, Blair was a weakened and spent force because he had destroyed his own political capital in Britain by his sponsorship of the Iraq War. There was only one man left who could have convinced Bush that it was time to attack, and that was Sharon. But now Sharon has been felled by this medical crisis. So, according to this scenario, the United States fails to attack Iran and destroy all the nuclear laboratories and nuclear facilities during 2006. And that means that by 2007, the Iranians have a missile pointed at Israel, the Israelis have their missiles pointed back at Iran, and in the year 2007, in August, a year and a half from now, we get a nuclear exchange between Israel and Iran. And that leads to what looks like a world war that goes on from 2007 to 2011. The one thing that he stresses is that the United States forces in Iraq are annihilated. They're overrun by Iraqi Shiites acting to avenge what has been done to Iran. And he says at the end of his scenario, the Chinese are threatening to join the Iranians as they see the U.S. getting weaker. Anyway, there's one scenario.
Yep.
Now, I'll give you another one. I think that's the neocon scenario. Here's a more realistic scenario. This is a much better scenario, I would say. This comes from a guy called Rajab Safarov. And Rajab Safarov is the head of the Contemporary Iran Study Center in Moscow. And he gave this to Iranian National News Agency, IRNA, Dateline Moscow, January 17th. So, he says, look, the pressure that is being put on Iran because of its nuclear program may lead to a global crisis comparable to World War II. And he's talking to Interfax News Agency of Russia. He says, the aftermath of the unwise proposals, bracket of the neocons, end bracket, would be catastrophe at a very wide and unpredictable dimension. And it would create chaotic conditions in the world economy. So he says, first of all, if Iran decides to, they can block the Straits of Hormuz, which would, he thinks, bring the price of oil up to $100 per barrel, and I think maybe more. In any case, in that case, the economies of many strong countries would face serious problems, and they would lose their power to compete, says Safarov of the Contemporary Iran Study Center in Moscow. He says, Iran has significant missile capability. This can be used against the U.S. forces based in the Persian Gulf states. It's not just Iraq, right, but it's Dubai, Saudi Arabia, and others. We have U.S. and Israeli forces in Turkey that can be hit. We have the U.S. Fifth Fleet. We have Israel in toto. Everything in Israel could become a target. And we have these oil tankers in the Gulf in the range of Iranian missiles. So he says, all you have to do is sink two oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, and you block the entire flow of oil through that strategic waterway for a period that is indefinite. So he says, and this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, for all those reasons, a resort to military force against Iran is not possible in the foreseeable future. And he wants to make it specific. Any type of direct interference in Iran or a military attack would equal suicide for the United States, and therefore is extremely unlikely. So he says the worst case scenario is that the question of the Iran, you know, the nuclear case of Iran, would be pushed by the International Atomic Energy Agency Board of Governors, that is El Baradei and company, would go to the Security Council, and that would impose serious economic sanctions. But that would not be decisive. That would not really hurt Iran that much. And he stresses again, no country in the world, not even the United States, has the capacity to impose a military solution on Iran. So why even start? And I guess that is about where we are. Just a couple of other things here from
Yeah,
Washington.
We got about a minute or two here. We'll start
We just had another Bin Laden tape today, and some of this stuff is getting through. In the past, Keith Olbermann of MSNBC has been very skeptical about these tapes and warnings. Today we have a guy called Cafferty on the Wolf Blitzer program, even on CNN,
uh-huh.
And they ask people to, that they ended up putting on were, if there's a new Osama bin Laden tape, it simply means that Bush and the Republicans are in trouble. And they actually, another one said, oh, bin Laden is working from the White House. He's working out of the White House. So this is a level of skepticism which I think is very healthy and which has even penetrated into the quite corrupt and spook-dominated television networks. So I guess that's it from Washington for this week. And again, if you want to get my book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA, the new edition, the new second edition, is now available at Amazon.com.
Terrific. Well, Webster, once again, you've given us a great backup and kept us on the straight and narrow here. There's no doubt there's a lot of misinformation out there, and it's wonderful having you here to update us. And next week we'll look forward to you be coming back Thursday, and Sherman will be back here, and I'm sure we'll be there'll be a lot more information, a lot more things happening as we get closer and closer to a new wag the dog they seem to be looking at pulling off in order to get America into the war in Iran. I don't
know. Mark your calendar. The next step is February 2nd, the meeting of the IAEA in Vienna. That's where they'll try to get it sent to the Security Council, and they may succeed or they may fail. That is Condi, Cheney, and company.
Terrific. Well, listen, thanks very much for your update, and we'll look forward to hearing you again from you next week.
See you next week.
Good night.
Stay well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You missed a very dull TV show about Auschwitz. More gruesome film clips and more puzzled intellectuals declaring their mystification over the systematic murder of millions. The reason why they can never answer the question, how could it possibly happen, is that it's the wrong question. Given what people are, the question is, why doesn't it happen more often? Of course it does, in subtler form. It's been ages since I sat in front of the TV. Just changing channels to find something. You see, the whole culture, Nazis, deodorant salesmen, wrestlers, beauty contests, the talk show. Can you imagine the level of a mind that watches wrestling? But the worst are the fundamentalist preachers, third-rate con men telling the poor suckers that watch them that they speak for Jesus and to please send in money, 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 money. If Jesus came back and saw what's going on in his name, he'd never stop growing up.